welcome to another episode of the ImproPod podcast. My guest today is Rod Berger, who's a multimedia personality and author, and who's interviewed over 4,000 people, including the late Pope Francis, Hall of Famer Magic Johnson, and the Crown Princess and future Queen of Sweden. Welcome to the podcast. That's amazing. How did you get into that position, become such a personality?
It's a big question, Luke. How did I get there? You interview one person, and then you find, wait a minute, they have people that they know, or they're a part of an interesting sector or a storyline. And then once some of their contemporaries hear that they had a good experience with you, then they're willing to be interviewed, and you start stacking that up. The shortest way to put it is that I was never sector specific. I've never just interviewed one type of person or around one central theme. And I've done that, I'd like to think, to my advantage so that I get a better grasp and understanding of just humanity, all ages, backgrounds, places around the world, political views, and that has helped me hopefully be a better storyteller and one who enjoys capturing people's stories. I'm normally the one on the other side of the microphone asking questions of the people that I'm looking at. And so this is it's a different place for me. It's very humbling because of my book and the people that I've shared their stories now and memorialized them in my experience of their stories.
So your book, A Narrative Edge, Authentic Storytelling That Meets the Moment. What's that about?
The book is about the relationship we have with stories in our lives and understanding that stories are not something that we can just add on. Stories are a part of our DNA. And the relationship we have can be bumpy, it can be engaging, it can be warm and comforting, it can be all of that all at once. And so this book is a little bit of me. It's also a book that I'd like to think bends the curve on where stories are when we don't even know that they're there or that they're present. So I take you in a given chapter from inside Nazi Germany. My late father grew up as a young person in Nazi Germany, and so I share a story and really a scene from that. I take you to Rome and the late Pope Francis, to Mvepi refugee settlement in Northwest Uganda, behind the scenes at Formula One, graveside when I had to give a eulogy to a very young family member that had passed away. Really, the notion, Luke, is that I want us to think in a much more present way about the power of story and the representation of that. Because I say in the book, in essence, if you're not in control of your story, who is? And I think that if there's ever a day and age where we really need to be thinking about our story, I think it's now. Daniel Pink, a New York Times bestselling author and someone that I'm honored to have said that I've interviewed in the past, he says, we're stimulus rich and context poor. And I'm doing my little part with this book, Luke, to hopefully provide context and substance to a world that is flying by us in ones and zeros at a rate that we've never experienced before.
I think people don't often appreciate the power of stories. In the past, the process of gaining knowledge was very much story orientated.
Yeah, the bridge almost, right, to that understanding has been through story. I had the opportunity, and I talk about in the book, to be at the refugee settlement, and I was there to study storytelling in Eastern Africa that has been going on for generations and the impact colonization has had, and to this day, on the way in which locals perceive themselves, their heritage, what was taken from them. I am so excited just to be on this podcast to think about sort of the inspiration and the way music plays a role in the stories that you tell and the medium that you use. But it was fascinating to be every night around a fire in a given area of that refugee camp and have people talk about, obviously through translation, stories that had meant something to them their whole lives. And they were always based from the animal kingdom, which I find fascinating. When you break it down to its simplest and most basic elements, story can be told in ways that don't have to be overcomplicated, right? There's a protagonist, there's a response, there's an environment or a stage or a scene, and then the lessons that hopefully come from those efforts. And those are very impactful for me. But yeah, you're right. I think that story has been the bridge to knowledge forever. And now it's going to probably play a different role, a new role, given AI in a world where answers are provided and the pursuit of knowledge is going to shift, I think.
I'm going to play a piece of music, and I'd like you to tell me what it makes you think of. So that's anything that comes into your mind. Don't analyze it too much.
Okay.
And it's completely improvised. I haven't thought about it. I'm making it up on the spot.
That was beautiful. The very first thing, without analyzing at all, was resolution was the word that was coming to mind that felt like there was the conflict in the beginning, that battle internally, and the resolution that we seek. And now, of course, I've been primed by thinking about stories I just shared about the refugee camp, and I think I was probably within that environment as you started playing, and so I thought about a specific individual. Yeah, resolution. It's all the conversations we don't share, right, that we have with ourselves. We don't share with our friends, our spouses, our kids, our bosses, our colleagues, and those can be taxing and also exhilarating.
So the idea of resolution, this note A, it was almost like a beacon.
Yeah, it like pings you internally, right? You have this notion that you're not just passing it by. I was thinking about a young man named Mawa Emanuel. He was a refugee that I met who was 20, I believe, 6 at the time. And he had basically aged out of going to the school there at the refugee camp, where the student-to-teacher ratio was around 600 to 1. And he had dreams of being a medical doctor. So he was basically in educational purgatory because he couldn't go back to South Sudan where most of his family had been killed. If you could write a song, given your talent, just by looking at his eyes, I think you would write for days songs. So I've ever looked into somebody's eyes and seen so much depth, dark, but not dark in a scary way, just dark from a human perspective and what he had been going through and what had been taken from him. And so the following day, I was walking with somebody and I saw him in the distance sitting in just this dark green plastic chair. And the reason why I give you that detail is because one of the things I found in my travels and in the developing world is that you'll find things from the West that it almost feels like they've been cast off. Products, shirts, clothing, and you just think, what time warp did I fall into? What rabbit hole? And you'll see these plastic chairs sort of everywhere. And he was sitting just staring out at the horizon for no other reason than that's what he was doing. And so the beginning of what you started to play there, given that I just talked about that refugee camp, I think about him and how he was born during a time of war and conflict. A lot of times the young people will be given a name that will basically designate when they were born. So it's almost like a scarlet letter. So that's something that has been, especially in writing the book and relaying that story in the book, it's something where I think of him on a regular basis, and he has no idea, obviously, because he's thousands of miles away, but it's that kind of resolution, finding a resolution to that story and hoping that he has found something that has brightened his eyes.
And so you would say there's something about that tune, which almost like a theme tune.
Yeah, there's a reality to it. What I appreciated about it, it didn't just go straight into the resolution, right? It's like good writing, or when you watch a movie, you appreciate the screenwriter because they didn't cheat your experience as an audience member. Or if you're listening to a song, you kind of want to play a role in it, right? You want to figure out the plot. You don't want to be given it. And so you didn't do that. So I appreciated that because it wasn't tied up and into a neat little bow.
Interesting, isn't it? Because sometimes it can be quite unsatisfying, even if you have a piece of music that has a resolution that's so obvious, just gives it away, gives the plot away.
So true.
If I play something like, what was that? Where was the experience? I started off playing this note A and then started playing around the D harmonic minor scale. And that eventually resolved into sort of A minor. The harmonic minor scale is often associated with Arabic places, which is, and it's cliche if you listen to Lawrence of Arabia or many of those films that are set in deserts. You'll often hear this kind of interval, this. I guess people who are actually from those places probably hate it.
I will tell you, when you said that, it made me think about the time I was in Dakar, Senegal. I immediately thought of that rooftop where it was incredibly windy and you're looking out over to the ocean and then you hear this call to prayer and just the sound of that. It's so incredible to think about your relationship to sound when something like that is put out at such a decibel level that you can hear it across a capital city. And just sort of sit with that as a feeling that it's not something that we experience here for me in the U.S. For me, it has nothing to do with a religion or a set of beliefs. There's a romanticism to the relationship that we have to sound and the way in which it influences the way we can think and or alter our thinking in a given moment, right? We can walk into a room not particularly feeling ourselves, and within moments, our mood is changed just by the power of sound, and obviously music, and the power of voice is a big part of that.
I'd like you to tell me a story of some kind. Then I'm going to improvise a soundtrack to the story.
I had an opportunity to interview a UFC Hall of Famer, Khabib Nurmagomedov. And then I said, I think we should do it inside the octagon. I'm not an MMA fan by just nature, but I'm a sports fan. And so they said, yeah, let's do that. What was so fascinating to me is that most people would interview a Hall of Fame athlete like that about their athletic career. But the irony is the thing that Khabib wanted to talk about was his desire was to go back to his homeland of Dagestan and to sell vegetables and tomatoes, was the one that he mentioned, to his fellow villagers, and to think about somebody that would create such fear in their opponents. He was described as terrifying. To come from that perspective to one where his dream is to go back and to support villagers and to be with them, right, in body and spirit, I'd found incredibly powerful. And the lightness with which he communicated that story, I think it was surprising even to his own people that he was able to, through our conversation, laugh and engage in a way that was a bit different, because he wasn't having to talk about his rivalry with Conor McGregor or anybody else, right? This was just him as a human being, someone who had worked incredibly hard and was now thinking about what life post-career was going to look like and how he wanted that picture to be painted.
He's kind of got this longing for simplicity. Okay, so musically I'm going to go for this strong, intimidating athlete.
Incredibly so. He was famous, there are YouTube videos, as a kid he was wrestling bears. You can imagine the shock, not shock, but the surprise for me when I asked whatever the question was that got him to say that, and he's talking about selling vegetables to his fellow villager. That was the response on the video clips that went out through his channels and went viral. That a lot of his fans, they just had never heard that before. There was something, it was like a connective tissue to it, right? It bonded him with his fans in a way that was very different than what you would think.
I'm going to go for this credible sense of strength and intimidation that Abdul Khabib has, then explore this longing for simplicity. He just wants to go back to his village and sell vegetables. So what did you think of that?
So for me, it started off as if there was a pace to running upstairs. There was this angst about these stairs. And then you're sort of in this tightrope where you see both sides, right? You see the side that you feel that you have to pay homage to, like the way in which people experience you. And the other side of the tightrope is maintaining a sense of self and authenticity. As it goes back to that resolution, there's a resolution or there's an understanding, a calmness.
I got a sense of that sensitivity, that other side. Did that come across? I was literally imagining the village ways, like selling these vegetables. What is the atmosphere like? I'm sometimes exaggerating the visual element in my mind when I'm playing it in order to try and get a sense of the vibe. So I'm not really thinking about the notes at all.
So when you're composing in real time, you almost have to bolster the energy behind whatever that is. You're creating enough of an umbrella under which then you can find the notes that make the most sense within that story.
I say that's quite accurate, because if I restrict myself too much, then obviously I'm doing this on the fly, and so that it doesn't really work. So I have to sort of just visualize the event or the atmosphere somehow, and then things will come to me, like the A major kind of sound. I feel that is quite a optimistic, simpler times vibe. A lift.
Yeah, it is. I get that lift when you do that.
So would you like to tell me another story?
For me, sports as a kid were so important, as if they were a family member. Just the notion of the teams that I supported. My mood, my perspective on optimism would rise and fall like a note or a series of notes based on what had happened the previous night. I would put posters and news clippings of the championships and accomplishments up on my ceiling, Luke, because when I went to bed, no matter what had happened in my day as a young person, that's what I wanted to see. So it was 1988. I was 11 going on 12, and my Detroit Pistons were in the NBA Finals for the first time against the vaunted Los Angeles Lakers and Magic Johnson. And we lost that championship, and I remember that day getting everything set, what I was going to eat. This was going to be a coronation and my first time celebrating. And we lost in dramatic fashion, and it was the first time that I can recall that I cried about something that wasn't directly impacting me. It wasn't that I'd fallen off of a bike or been punched at school or anything like that. And just the devastation at that age was really powerful. I don't believe that I had experienced a death up until that point as a young person. That felt like a death to me. Now, to connect that story, just a couple of years ago, I interviewed Magic Johnson, and it was in Los Angeles. That's how I opened up my interview. I joked with Magic that I wanted him to basically come clean, that it was a phantom foul that sort of crushed my young dreams. And I'm looking at that picture now because there was a staffer there that caught that candid moment. And I look at that and think, wow, that was decades in the making. That was a bit of resolution in the way in which he responded in such a caring and engaging way with me. But in the moment, was incredibly crushing as a young person.
And so should I go for that sense of that crushing feeling?
It feels like a compressed element, right? To experience all the emotions within, let's say, a 2.5 hour window. Life isn't that compact. And yet something like that is where the anticipation is so high that you run the risk of falling over from exhaustion, because every cell in your body goes towards sending sort of these good vibrations thousands of miles away to a game that you have no impact on. And yet through the rhythm of the game, just like in a song, you're bouncing like a pinball, and ultimately that pinball is lost at the end. And that was not what was expected at all. It was a crash. It was a cliff, right? There was no suspense. You had fallen to your doom. And that's what it can feel like when you are an avid fan, and especially at that age. So when I see young people now crying on social media when their teams lose, I think, I know, young person, exactly how you feel. I've been there, and it's hard for me to watch you and your sadness.
you thought they were going to win, right? You had a very strong optimism to start with.
Absolutely. I saw them as family, is how I should put it. These were my family members. And I had been lucky enough to meet a couple just as a kid through youth sports prior to that. So you just have this absolute connection. It's really a first love, is what it is. Because they give you something that you can't find in your day-to-day. There is this anticipation, there's excitement, there are things to look forward to and to rebound from. It really gives you an initial opportunity as a young person to experience the spectrum of emotions that just in what it means to be human. And I've seen that too. I've seen now my own kids, they support the same teams now that I did. Funny how that works. And when it hasn't gone our way, I've seen the sort of the crushing defeat in them. And I've had to now with wisdom and sort of resolution to your previous interlude there was around, there's something powerful about being this passionate about a team that you support. And we're really lucky to be able to experience that. And there will be days that we will absolutely celebrate and those that we don't want to get out of bed because we're just so upset. And that's okay, because that's what it means to be human. And we're incredibly lucky.
Do you remember the game at all? Do you remember the specific points in the game that shifted it?
Oh, it was in the last second. There was a phantom foul that was called on Bill Laimbeer and put Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, arguably one of the top three greatest players in NBA history, on the free throw line to win the game. It was anticlimactic in that way. It was so crushing to think that something you had this crescendo of an event to end with such a whimper. There wasn't this spectacular catch or run or steal in the game and a three-pointer at the buzzer, right? There, it wasn't that kind of loss where you almost have to say, you have to tip your hat to the person, to the player that sort of crushed your dreams. The suddenness of it, I think, is what I would underscore. It's the suddenness that is hard to understand. And I think for your work and the power of music is that as we hear a new song, we think we can figure out the notes that are coming. You fall into this sort of, this almost hypnosis, right? With a song that you immediately resonate with. And then if it takes a turn, it's almost like jolting. Because it's almost as if I was writing it with you and then you went in a different direction, Luke. How dare you? As I listen on the radio.
I'm going to go for this sort of sense of connection you have with this team. You're with them, even though they're thousands of miles away. And this optimism and then this sudden sort of cacophony of disappointment. So what did you think of that?
In the beginning, what I loved about it was it had this sense of, it's like the child wonderment, and yet some might call it naivete, right? That you just have this blind confidence that it's all going to work out because maybe things in life just generally work out for you, right? As a young person, everything's fun and you play and you go to school. You don't have the trials maybe of adulthood, and you're bebopping along and enjoying it. And then you do hit that cliff. So as you took me over the cliff, Luke, I had two images. One was of the classic, at least here in the States, holiday show called Frosty the Snowman, where, you know, Frosty starts melting and it's just like the big sort of puffed up sense and the childlike nature of Frosty. And then just literally just in before your eyes melting. And the other was the closing scene in the, what I call classic movie, Big, with Tom Hanks, where as Elizabeth Perkins, the actress, looks down and she drops him off in front of his house and she looks back up, all of a sudden he's back to being his kid self, but he's walking in the clothes of the adult that he had just embodied, right? There's this sinking feeling that you now are understanding life and the realities of life in a way that bridge or give you a preview of what it's like post-childhood. It wasn't a cliff as if there was a, like, death at the bottom of the valley when you fell. It was like it still continued, hence the Frosty the Snowman, right? So you drop all the way down and then, okay, you're melting away. And that's exactly how it felt. And I can promise you, I'm probably going to have some very odd dreams and potentially nightmares later this evening when I lay down after thinking about this.
And so that sense of the optimism, that childlike optimism, and I was trying to get the excitement of the game, that kind of, was it like big, quite wide chords? Experimenting with this idea of falling, like your sense of hope is falling away. So did you get the sense of the transition?
Oh, yeah. There was this sort of bebopping notion in the beginning, which is very kid-like. I was running in the kitchen, getting whatever I was going to eat, and I'm running back, and I'm hearing the intro music to CBS Sports. It's just part of that rhythm.
So what did you get out of this podcast?
Oh my goodness, you've made an imprint in my mind. What an incredible opportunity. So I appreciate you as a fellow storyteller and have great affinity for the talent that you display and for putting it together in a way that is very unique. As you noted in the opening, I have done my fair share of interviews. This is a first for me, right? I've been a part of meetings where people are illustrative and incredibly creative, where they can, in the moment, visually draw, in essence, what's happening. And that's very powerful visually. But I've never had this. So thank you. This is one I will absolutely remember for quite some time.
Well, thank you very much. If people want to find out more about you, how can they do that?
I'm just Dr. Rod Berger on all my website. That's just drrodberger.com. And at Dr. Rod Berger is my Instagram. Same for LinkedIn. Those would be the two main ones. And I'd be humbled if you consider pre-ordering my book, The Narrative Edge, Authentic Storytelling That Meets the Moment. Wiley is my publisher. You can find the links. It is now available anywhere books are sold around the world. If you like a good story and one that incorporates you as the reader in ways to think about the power of your story and that they all matter, I hope that it will help to platform and put out more stories of people that otherwise would not have the opportunity to do so. If that's the contribution I can make in this world, just as you are with your music and talents, Luke, then that's what I'll do.
Great. Appreciate it. Thank you very much. Join us again for another episode of ImproPod.